Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert, for part one of today's show is consumer expert Grace Gorsden. She'll be taking a look at the current energy crisis and what you should do if your firm goes bust. Then pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries will take the baton to update us on the state pension fiasco. Plus, Simon runs a rule over Chase, the new current account from JP Morgan. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app. But first, last week it was stagflation. Now it's high energy prices and rationing of oil and petrol to forecourts. Are the 70s back? Are we in line for a second winter of discontent? High inflation, higher bills, universal credit uplift disappearing, the end of furlough, tax hikes on the horizon. Before we get stuck into the energy situation with Grace, Simon, is there trouble ahead?
The 2020s, hey? Aren't they just the gift that keeps on giving? Yes. So we had the decision, the curious decision of petrol retailers and the government to tell people not to panic buy fuel yesterday. Don't press the red button. No, don't press that red button. Yeah, so people are panic buying fuel now. At the end of a working week in which started with an energy crisis to do with our gas, has now ended with panic buying fuel. We've already got supermarket shelves that are half empty. And I'd like to tip my hat to the co-op, my local co-op, that has decided to try to cover up the empty shelves in its fridges by filling them with sauce.
With what?
So basically, you know, when you go in, it's like a proper size supermarket size co-op.
Right.
You walk down the chiller aisle. Now, normally on the left-hand side, you just have that row of fridges and it's full of meat. Okay, that's like where they keep the meat. So the meat, that's the meat aisle. It's been a bit empty for a while now, to be honest. And apparently it's going to get more empty because we don't have enough CO2.
Yeah.
Only last week we had too much CO2 because that was bad for the environment. And we don't have enough CO2. Yeah. It's very confusing. But what they've decided to do, some artful soul has filled the empty fridges to make them presumably look less empty, squeeze the meat up. And they are full of bottles of mayonnaise, daddy sauce, and I don't think ketchup, but only because that would be too much of an issue that would divide the customers, because everyone knows there's a big debate as to whether you should keep ketchup in the fridge or not.
Clearly, it goes in the fridge.
But yes, I'm not sure whether we're going to see similar tactics from other hit industries, whether the petrol stations will be artfully covering the closed petrol pumps with bottles of sauce and things like that. So you don't realize
who needs petrol. Fill
it's
up
like,
with
oh,
some ketchup.
I was going to come in for some petrol, but actually, I just buy some sauce. It's totally fine.
Simon, does it explain to me? Because I as we know, I'm out in Spain. I've been here for about a month, and I'm getting all of these. I'm coming home soon. I'm a bit nervous about coming back. I'll be totally honest with you, Simon. I'm thinking of staying here. I've not seen any queues at petrol pumps. The sauces are not in the fridge. It seems pretty normal here. I'm a bit nervous. Should I be?
I guess it depends when you get back. I mean, I'm looking at the calendar now. It's the 24th of September.
Yeah.
I'm thinking anything after maybe the 10th of October is probably going to be zombie apocalypse. So it depends if you want to either get back and get yourself hunkered down in time for that. Or
should
whether
I bring
you want to come
suitcases
back into the
of toilet paper?
Apocalypse.
Or
just bring lorry drivers.
Okay, right.
Basically, just bring lorry drivers. Look, there is apparently no shortage of petrol. It's
What's
a shortage of
on?
Lorry drivers. They can't deliver enough petrol. BP said that it had a bit of a problem, and then obviously it spreads and people start buying, panic buying petrol, and obviously, as with anything, we operate in the system whereby we have enough supply for people to buy stuff in normal purchasing patterns. And if somebody suddenly makes a run on something and starts to try to buy something in more than their usual purchasing patterns, then you have an issue. Now, if there is no shortage of petrol and there's only a shortage of lorry drivers to deliver it, this only really becomes an issue if people buy so much petrol that we do then start to have a shortage of petrol. If everybody just calms down, they could probably get enough petrol to get around. But it is a problem if your tank's empty. And then, so that's why people go and they panic buy the petrol. And these are reminiscent of the scenes seen in 2000, the fuel shortage in 2000. a period of time when I was fortunately not in the country. I was away on a long trip to Morocco with a friend, and this was pre-internet, so I didn't really know much about it until we had some kind of message from home, and then we were like, what? They're doing what? So apparently it's fine, but also apparently it's fine. The energy thing's fine. You don't need to worry about it. You're not going to run out of energy and so on. I think everybody just possibly needs to take a step back and calm down, but that is not how panic buying works. Panic buying does not work by people taking a step back and calming down.
No, it doesn't. But that's petrol, and that's the situation there. But when you throw everything together, as I mentioned earlier, with the higher bills that we're likely to get, universal credit uplift disappearing, we're getting taxed, national insurance rises next year, end of furlough, et cetera, et cetera. Are you worried?
No, I think it's fine. I'm a glass half full kind of person. A petrol tank half full kind of person.
Nice.
I think that it's fine. And we've been assured by ministers that there is no question of the lights going out, of people being unable to heat their homes. There will be no 3-day working week or a throwback to the 1970s.
Right.
And if the MPs tell you it's fine, it's going to be totally fine. I know, I think it's fine. It's just one of those things. It's kind of a perfect storm that's hitting at the moment. The lorry driver thing is getting worse, but they are offering lorry drivers quite large sums of money now. They're trying to get more HGV drivers through. There's been a problem where a lot of people have taken early retirement. They've reassessed stuff in the pandemic, gone, I don't want to continue doing this, and they've taken early retirement. As we talked about last week, there's also lots of industries that people don't want to go into because they consider them either to be too low paid in some cases, or in other cases, not highly paid enough for the hassle that's involved. And it is quite hard work being a lorry driver.
Yeah.
So I think this will iron itself out. I think we've just got a few bumpy months to come. The problem is, as we talked about last week, is it going to start really hitting us in the pocket in terms of inflation?
And will it?
Quite possibly, yes.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about the energy crisis then. We have one. As a result of rising wholesale gas costs, bills will likely go up over the coming months, and after a spate of smaller firms went bust, 1.5 million people now face being switched to a new, more expensive provider. But why is this all happening? Grace, why a shortage of gas?
Okay, so there's a number of factors, but ultimately it's due to a lack of gas being produced as well as an increase in demand. Demand has rebounded quicker than expected after the pandemic, with reserves being slower to fill. I think one of the main things is that supply from Russia has been less than predicted, and there's been higher demand in Asia for liquefied natural gas, which means there's been less than expected reaching Europe. Other things that have happened that haven't helped include last winter being much longer and colder than normal, therefore more people using more energy. And there's also been a lower output from renewable sources, such as solar power and wind especially, I believe, therefore creating a heavier reliance on gas. So there's a number of things, but ultimately is just more demand and less supply.
So the wholesale price going up, and obviously companies wanting to put that on consumers, but they can only do it by so much because we have an energy price cap. How much have prices increased, and how much therefore will our bills go up? Because they can only, like I said, they can only go up by a certain amount.
Well, wholesale prices are up 250% since January and 70% alone since August. So, I mean, it's increasing rapidly. In terms of bills, if you are a fixed tariff customer who has got months, if not years, left on your deal, you're not going to see an increase in prices because you are fixed. Therefore, it's not going to affect you as of yet. Again, if you're a standard default customer, again, you're not really going to be as affected as you might think because of the energy price cap, which is moving to £1,277 as of next week, 1st of October. So you can't physically pay any more than that. Where people will be paying more is those who are on fixed deals that are coming to an end soon. So they'll be looking perhaps for another fixed deal or even moving to a standard tariff. And the fixed deals now are hundreds and hundreds of pounds more expensive than they were earlier in the year. So that's where it's really going to hit people. And we have always said on This Is Money, you know, try and go for a fixed deal, much better value than a standard default tariff. But actually now I think those whose fixed tariff is coming to an end might actually be better off on a standard default tariff after all.
Goodness me. If people are struggling, what help is available?
So there are a couple of things that people can do. There's the warm home discount, which is for those who are on low income households and on pensions. They can get a £140 discount. However, we did a story on this actually. People should apply sooner rather than later, because there is only a limited number of spaces available, which I don't think everyone knows. So if you do think you're eligible, apply now, contact your supplier. There's winter fuel payments available for those who get the state pension or another social security benefit. Now, if it gets really cold over winter between November and March, people can also get a cold weather payment. It's £25 if your area, your household is reaching below zero for 7 days in a row. So those are the things you can do. If you are struggling to pay, perhaps worried about debt, talk to your supplier, and you can get free impartial advice from people like Step Change. And I think supplier in most cases would be the best person to speak to if you are struggling to pay at all.
Now, Simon reckons apocalypse is coming on October the 10th. What's your view? Is this likely to be resolved anytime soon?
No, I don't think it will be. I think that what will happen over the next weeks and months, we're going to see a lot more small suppliers collapse, unfortunately. There's been some people that have said there'll be just 10 at the end of the year, as opposed to 40 at the start of year, and there were 70 last year. Now, obviously, that's a massive decrease. Whether that number is going to be accurate or not, there's definitely going to be more people, more suppliers collapsing, more customers left without providers for a while. I think the problem is that at the moment, with these smaller suppliers collapsing, for example, Avro Green, they are being found suppliers, you know, with British Gas, E.ON, some of the big six. However, there must be a limit to how much they can take on. They can't just keep on taking millions and millions and millions of customers, because then they have to buy more energy, costs will go up, and then it's just this vicious cycle of people paying more money anyway. When it will be resolved, I wouldn't like to say, but I think until the end of this year, according to some experts, there will be a lot of suppliers collapsing, a lot of problems, and possibly much higher bills for customers.
I want to go more into the suppliers collapsing, not least because I keep getting emails from Uswitch saying, you recently switched to Avro and we need to talk to you. And it's like, oh no, that was years ago. But yeah, what's going on there? What's the model that means that, wasn't it some time ago, and I can't remember the stats, that there's something like 80 suppliers and now we're down to 30, and we're probably going to be down to even less than that. What's the model of energy that we've got a situation where? Because it sounds really scary, doesn't it, Simon?
Yes. So the model of energy, you've got to remember we're coming from a position where we were very unhappy with what was known as the big six at the time. We thought they were like driving up people's bills, going up too high, not coming down fast enough. So the answer to this was competition. You've seen, obviously, the rise of switching. At the same time, encouraging people to switch. And up until now, it has been true that if you had never switched your bills, on average, you could probably save about £300. So switching was worth it. Now, some people would advise you to be switching all the time, switching more than once a year. I've always felt that if you really, really want to do that, that's absolutely fine. The big money's to be made on the first switch. And actually, it is a bit of hassle. There is the element where, for example, smart meters can go dumb. You go to different billing systems, you might end up with a final bill from one that seems quite large, or the first bill from the other. I've always found switching to be okay, but not my favorite thing to do, and not something I would want to be doing more than once a year, probably not even once a year. Okay. Into this sort of scenario stepped lots of small suppliers who were encouraged to set up, and also because of the way the system works is you don't actually, you know, the gas that is being supplied and the electricity that's being supplied, you know, they're not generating it themselves. Okay, it comes in here and it goes out there, and they effectively just act as a middleman. And the way that they scoop up customers is by trying to be the cheapest. So they try to undercut the prices of the big companies. Now, they can do that because they're quite capital light. They don't have the same historic obligations in terms of, you know, anything ranging from staffing costs to pension schemes to customer service and so on. You know, you can set up cheaper than you can run a legacy business. There has also been examples where, for, you know, there was a point where the same kind of green levies and stuff were not impacting their customers quite as much. And so they're undercutting the big companies and pulling in customers. Now, they're not really making much money, but the idea is, in any kind of fast growth energy scenario, you know, not fast, any kind of these fast growth business scenarios, you see this with digital companies as well. It's like, don't worry about making money now. It's jam tomorrow. We're going to make money in the future. But it's actually really about building up a big customer base, because once you've got X number of customers, hey, somebody might come and buy you out. It's not really happened in the energy sector, where people have looked at some of these small suppliers and gone, actually, maybe they're not such great businesses. And we've seen quite a few of them go bust some time ago. Them going bust is not a new phenomenon. But obviously, this has stepped up now. And the big problem is, of course, is that the bigger suppliers have deeper pockets. They buy more of their energy in advance. They do more what's called hedging of their costs. So they can pretty much know how much the energy they're going to supply to their customers is going to cost them, because they've secured a lot of that in advance. The smaller suppliers have not so deep pockets. They don't do quite so much of that. And also, if you've got more customers on a variable rate, on a cheap variable rate, then you've got a bit of an issue, because there's the price cap. And if all of a sudden the cost of the wholesale gas goes up through the cost of the price cap, all of a sudden you have agreed to sell people gas for less than it is costing you. And that's the fundamental issue here with, for a lot of these small suppliers, is that they are having to sell people energy for less than the energy is costing, for less than the energy is costing them. So they're making a loss with every single unit of energy that some of their customers use. They're not as well hedged as others, and they can't scoop up new customers anymore. In fact, they don't want new customers because they're losing money on all of it, but they can't scoop up new customers anymore, because they can't really offer any meaningful, you know, deals to people. They can't really offer them a standard variable deal because they're losing money on it. And a fix, they could offer them a fix. And there are some people offering people fixes, but the fixes are way more expensive than what you'd be paying on the standard variable rate at the moment, and way more expensive than most people would be paying right now. So I did a comparison the other day on one of the comparison sites that's still offering comparisons, and some of them aren't. Compare the Market, which is This Is Money's energy partner, stopped offering comparisons last week because it said it couldn't offer any meaningful comparisons at the moment. It just wasn't an opportunity to do so, because most of the deals that people were being offered were more expensive. And so I did one the other day with another energy comparison site, and I could save minus £500. So I could have signed up for a new deal that was going to cost me £500 more than the one I'm on. The next best one that was on offer was the opportunity to save minus £700. Now, there was actually a bit of a warning from some people in the energy industry yesterday to telling people not to gamble on these deals, because actually some people are taking them out because they're thinking, oh, well, maybe I should take this out because prices are going to go up by so much that I'll gamble on this. And even though I'm locking into a deal that's, you know, £500, £700, £1,000 more expensive. But people are being advised not to do that because, well, firstly, they'd probably be better off just going on to the standard variable deal and looking for the safety of the price cap. And secondly, there's a suggestion that there might be an element of price gouging going on here, of trying to lure in the unwary and lock them in for 2 years.
I read a tweet from a smaller energy boss that said basically the winners in this are the big energy firms, because they can consolidate their, into a degree, form a position. Is that true?
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, the big energy firms, they're the ones rescuing the customers at the moment from the ones going bust, and they are effectively just scooping up more customers. I mean, we don't want to go back to the, you know, to the bad situation we were in. I mean, competition is a good thing. I just think that the competition has been slightly false and not really, you know, not built on the greatest foundations, to be honest. I mean, we joked a couple of years ago when there was this boom in energy companies about setting up a, you know, to fight about doing a story about finding out how easy it was to set one up and setting up a This Is Money energy company, you know, because there was certainly a mushrooming of these firms. Hopefully we won't go back to exactly where we were. We'll go back to a better situation. But I do think the days of there being, you know, 80, 90 different energy companies are gone.
Grace, your view? Can we sort this out, this mess out?
I agree with the fact that this will benefit bigger suppliers. I'm not saying that they've orchestrated it to be that way, but I've spoken to some smaller suppliers this week and previously who think there is still a lack of competition and the industry is still geared towards making it easier for bigger firms, the big six, to get more customers, charge more money and push out their smaller competitors. And that is what's happening here. Obviously, I'm not saying that bigger companies such as British Gas have, you know, orchestrated that the wholesale gas prices are going to go up by X amount. But they will probably at the end of the day be the only surviving ones if this continues at the rate it does. I think it will peter out at some point. It has to. But it's just by what point and how many suppliers will be left at that point, I think.
All right, Grace. So what is the practical advice if your provider goes bust? What should you do? Sit tight?
Yeah, you should absolutely sit tight. Ofgem says definitely do not switch supplier if you know your provider is going bust. This is because it can make it more difficult for customers to get any money they have left with their supplier back. I think it does create some problems. Instead, Ofgem will find consumers a new provider through their supplier of last resort system. This might take a few weeks at most, but they will find someone for you and that new supplier will get in contact with consumers directly. Consumers are asked not to get in contact with their new supplier. Wait until you hear from them. If it's been 2 weeks, then possibly get in touch. But otherwise, wait until you hear something. Otherwise, it can create a bit of confusion and a more backlog for the suppliers themselves. Some tips, though, from Ofgem, if you are getting a new supplier, take a meter reading, a note of your account balance, and keep any old bills you have. They also stress that you shouldn't cancel the direct debit with your old supplier until your new account is fully set up, just in case there's any problems along the way. But as I say, they will look after you. They will ensure you have a new supplier. Stay put and don't switch beforehand.
All right. And some more tips before I let you go. Energy costs set to soar this winter. You have a very useful article, Grace, where you reveal the top 10 tips on how you can cut down your consumption and lower your bills. So go.
Firstly, a simple one, but I think it's an effective one, is your heating controls, ensuring that you have your thermostat on a decent temperature, it's not too high. Information from Energy Saving Trust says if you turn down your thermostat by just 1 degree, it can save you as much as £8 per year. Also, there's smart heating controls now. They're quite popular. They're the ones who read who adapt to how you like the temperature of your home and they can reduce it or increase it as such. And I think they can be quite helpful. So if you are able to invest in one of them, they might be worth it. Another simple thing that you can do is draft proofing, especially for old houses, I believe. They can often be gaps between doors, windows, floorboards, that sort of thing. This can be quite an easy and cost-effective way to save energy, just using some foam strips, plastic seals to cover up the gaps, which will insulate your home a bit more and save you hopefully some energy. Just a couple of other things that are easy. If your shower is fed by hot water from the boiler, it's not an electric shower, get a water efficient shower head, which this is quite interesting. I found Energy Saving Trust said, if you can get one of these water efficient shower heads, it could reduce your usage by 32 litres a day. Now, I wasn't aware that people would be using that much, but apparently we all use an average of 145 litres per person every day. So if you can save it by 32 litres, that is quite a big saving. There are some other things you can do which are a bit more costly. For example, actually insulating your home with getting someone in to insulate your roof, for example, your walls, ensuring that you use less energy, and also upgrading your heating system if you can. There's a lot of information now and a push for people to get heat pumps. This isn't as simple as draft proofing your home, but if you can afford it, if you do have the space, these are the big investments that will save you more in the longer term.
Marvellous. Grace, thank you so much. It's time now to hand the baton over to Tanya. From energy bills to state pension fiascos. Many bereaved families whose relatives lost out on state pension might never see a penny of the money that they are owed. That's according to a new damning report into the failures of the Department for Work and Pensions. In a £1 billion scandal that was uncovered by This Is Money and, of course, our columnist, former pensions minister Steve Webb. Indeed, Tanya and Steve actually got a mention in the report. Well done. Public service journalism at its finest, Tanya. Tanya, tell us more about the report.
The National Audit Office is Parliament's spending watchdog, and it has done a really good and thorough investigation into what exactly happened here, what went wrong, why it happened, and what the DWP are doing to sort it out now, which is obviously the crucial bit for the people who were underpaid. One of the most serious things that has come out of it is the news about deceased people. The DWP destroys the state pension records of people either 4 years after they've died or after their spouse dies. A lot of the people who have been sending us emails, we've had an awful lot of messages from adult children who are asking about their parents' state pension. They remember their parents saying, their mum saying, oh, my state pension is so low. And they might not know the figures, but they do remember that. This means that the ones whose parents died many years ago might never see the money unless they have got some evidence to show the DWP about it. But we don't know about what the standard of evidence would be to prove that your parents were underpaid. We can give people some clues as to what they might gather up. But it's a really dismal development for people who their parents might have died years ago, but they've just lost out, like the ones that are alive and still retired now. Morally, their beneficiaries deserve the money as much as the living people who are being underpaid right now today.
What else is in it, Tanya?
There's a lot of interesting detail in it, so I'll run through some of the main points that we've picked out. The highest underpayment they've discovered to date was £128,500, and the oldest they've discovered goes back to 1985. And that length of time just shows, doesn't it, how many people might have died while being underpaid. The National Audit Office also says that because of these records going, the DWP doesn't actually know how many people whose records have been destroyed might have been underpaid. So that's a massive gap. Lots of other interesting things. The thing at the moment is 1 billion, but the Audit Office stresses that is highly uncertain. When they originally made an estimate, they said 2.7 billion, but the DWP's auditors said a couple of months ago that it could be anything between 620 million and 2.8 billion. So there's a real high degree of uncertainty about how much, how big this will be eventually. There's lots of interesting detail about how this went wrong, because this is one of the things we constantly ask the DWP. Every time I sent them new cases, I asked them how this error occurred. A bit more light is being shed on this. There are apparently three different computer systems, and to get a true picture of what somebody should be getting, you have to check all three systems. You have to have knowledge of the rules while you're doing this, and then you have to be able to interpret these rules correctly. And the Audit Office says that only a small group of specialist people at the DWP fully understand these rules. Since this was uncovered, I think it's fair to say that they've got a lot of knowledgeable staff being put onto this. The number is apparently going to go up to nearly 550 by next year. I understand that these are going to be caseworkers, but I really want to try and find out whether that is actually the case, because one of the things we've been hearing with people who are struggling to get their state pension started now, which we can get onto in a bit, they report to us that people are just answering the phone and taking messages. Now, I don't know how many of those 550 odd people are going to be caseworkers and how many are going to be taking messages. Let's hope they're going to be properly resourced. In terms of other things, there is mention of the strain that the big correction exercise is having on other parts of the service. new pension claims, that the Audit Office does not make the link directly. And I think I should stress that. They're not saying that the chaos we've been reporting the last couple of weeks in new state pension claims is caused by this. I mean, we've had a COVID pandemic and there have been other, you know, other issues at play. But they do say something quite interesting, which is that in July, there were 80,000 outstanding new state pension claims, whereas typically before the pandemic, it would have been 40,000 in a month. So that gives you an idea of the scale of the problem. We're still reporting on people who are struggling to get paid. And the DWP has promised to sort that out by the end of October. But obviously, they've got to turn around quite a big problem on that front as well.
So all in all, Tanya, a bit of a screw up on a monumental scale. I mean, the fact that you have three computer systems and no one actually knows how to work it. But what's the fallout of it? What's going to happen? Are we not going to have records thrown away after 4 years? What lessons are going to be learnt from this report? Or is it just going to be one that's going to gather dust in a shelf somewhere?
I really hope that it will have an impact. The Audit Office describes the DWP systems as unautomated. It doesn't sound like they're up to scratch, does it? So there has to be something done there. They also take the DWP to task about quality assurance, which is shorthand for how do they detect these problems? And apparently there is no system for, as the complaints come in, assessing, you know, where the big problems are. They sample it in various ways, detect fraud and various other problems, but they don't apparently sort of triage the incoming complaints and work out where a lot of people are complaining and there's a problem found about the same thing again and again. I find that actually quite extraordinary, because you'd think any modern call centre would monitor what people were saying and do some basic data analysis just on what people were ringing up about and where they were justified in their complaint, where the complaint was upheld. The Audit Office appears to be urging the DWP to change how it does that. In terms of what the DWP has said about it, they've, you know, said they're fully committed to ensuring that everybody gets paid. They point out that this problem has been going on under successive governments, which is a fair point. They say that they are improving the quality assurance and the training of staff. They have already. And they do actually reiterate again that the people whose parents have died, that money will be paid to the appropriate person, which means presumably the beneficiaries. There wasn't any comment on that I could see on these records being destroyed and what kind of evidence the people whose parents' records have been destroyed will have to come up with in order to get paid, or whether there's absolutely no hope whatsoever. Mm. But that is obviously going to be a big area, and we've already written a piece about that and about what people in the situation can do.
Well, what can people do?
Yes, if you are in this situation and you're listening to this, at the top of our pensions section at the moment, you'll find this article where we talk in some detail and Steve Webb weighs in and gives some advice. The DWP has recently given us a steer as well on what people should be sending. An NI number is not mandatory, but it will be really helpful. So if you can dig it out, all the better. Apart from that, it's the usual things like name, address, last known address, date of birth, date of death, all the above as well for a spouse, whether living or whether they've died too. Steve Webb gives a lot of helpful information as well about the kind of things, and this is particularly for people who think their the records might have been destroyed. Bank statements. Now, executors can request old bank statements. And interestingly, state pension payments appear on bank statements with an NI number. So if you can get your hands on those bank statements, that could be immensely helpful. He also says that old benefit statements and also health records, that you can try and look up old health records, maybe even try and go back to GPs. I don't know how helpful they'd be, but if you are really sure that your parent has been underpaid, that this is the kind of detective work I think you might have to do if the records have been destroyed.
Tania, thank you very much, and fantastic work. Simon, you've written your piece this week about this situation no report can express or show what these women have gone through, not having that extra money, that stress.
Yes, and I've watched firsthand as Tania and Steve have spent hours, you know, working on this and doing a huge amount of work, and massive credit to both of them for this. And people are now getting their money back. But from having spoken to Tania about this, you know, over the last year and a half, one of the things that comes through is that, you know, in many cases, these women felt short of money because they weren't getting what they were due. And it's that worrying about money that means that you didn't do things. You didn't enjoy your retirement in the way that you could have done. You know, the missed enjoyment of holidays, day trips, meals out, presents for the family, the grandchildren, other treats, that just having some more money coming in would have made the difference to. And also what they suffered as well, you know, the times when they would have worried about money or their bills, they turned the heating down, you know, sat there chilly, you know, or left it off, you know, scrimped on the food shop, said no to things that they would have enjoyed. And I had that over many years. And now, yes, they may be getting a lump sum, but for some, it will be too late to really enjoy that lump sum. They can't just head out and splurge and head off on holiday, you know, maybe due to age or ill health. And some are dead. And so it's too late. And now their families are getting the money, but they're not getting that extra bit of enjoyment in retirement that these women deserved. And so I think that's the real shame. That's the bit that you can't fix. And that's certainly something that, when we've talked about it, you know, Tania has highlighted to me, and I was reflecting that in my column this week.
All right, well, we'll leave that to one side. I'm sure we'll touch on it again in the future. But finally, Simon, what was it, 3 years ago, I think Goldman Sachs launched Marcus, the last big US bank to enter the retail banking market in the UK. Now we've got JP Morgan and Chase account. But is it any good? And can cashback debit cards with no numbers and 5% interest on savings roundups pull in the punters? Simon, your views.
It's funny how these recognisable global mega banks that people don't have particularly high opinions of don't launch in the UK using the name that the UK punters would recognise, isn't it? Marcus for Goldman Sachs, Chase for JP Morgan, except of course JP Morgan is JP Morgan Chase in the US, and in the US Chase would be obvious, I think, to most customers there. But over here it's like, ooh, it's another one of these new challenger banks. JP Morgan's not really a challenger bank. I mean, it might have been 100 odd years ago, but it's not really a challenger bank. But it's arrived with a deal that looks pretty tasty to some of our readers, and we've had a lot of interest from people in reading about this week. And so instead of arriving here and offering to dish out the cash, chucking £100 at people, as some of our existing banks and challengers do, to join up, Chase has just put some muscle behind its offer. So what can you get? Well, you've got some of the best bits that you might get with the digital only bank, like Monzo and Starling, combined with some nifty features of its own. So you'll get an app that helps out and is really good. It says that you are going to get savings from roundups. So basically, when you spend money, you can round it up to the nearest pound, and that will then go into a bit of your savings where you will get 5% interest. I mean, that's a big interest rate. The thing is, though, it's only on that roundup pot, and it's probably going to take you a while to build up much money in there. But still, you know, it's better than nothing. 1% cash back on all purchases. So rather than offering any imbalance interest, it's simply for 12 months on all your purchases in shops, online and abroad, you will get 1% cash back. And then there's no fees. And also it offers fee-free use abroad. And also, one quirky feature is a numberless debit card. The details are stored behind your secure login on the app, which apparently means a smaller risk if the physical card is lost and a new card number can be generated straight away, meaning a customer can continue to use the card digitally without worrying about waiting for a new card. I mean, this is kind of good. I must admit, though, I've got a bank account that doesn't have the full, it doesn't have the account number on it. It's got the card number on it, but not the account number. And it's really annoying when you need the account number.
Yeah.
Because you go to look in your wallet and it's not there, and then you go, oh, where is it? It must be written on here somewhere, and then you have to open the app, and it's quite annoying. You can set up like individual separate accounts, though. This is a kind of digital banky thing. You customize new accounts, personalize sort codes and account numbers, simple tap on the app, choose where your spending comes from. So for example, you could set up a separate account, really it's a pot, I guess, for your supermarket spend. Or any other things like that. And you can toggle between them using the app. So 24/7 call center and a chat feature, and seems like a decent addition to the banking options that people have got. And I think we're going to see more and more of this stuff in years to come as the existing banks start to really try to up their game in terms of stuff that you can do using their accounts in order to facilitate you better managing your money.
All right, then. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all the podcast past and join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.